So what was good enough for Lenin is apparently good enough for the Obama administration. No more czar. That's right. The Obama administration has apparently decided against appointing a czar to oversee the auto bailout restructuring. A Tuesday deadline will say a lot about what's on the road ahead. That is, besides the takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, America. It's No Car Czar Monday, President's Day. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is away. And Femi Okeh here has the stories we need to know about this morning.
Good morning, all. The Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, is now in Japan. And this kicks off an Asian tour, her first trip abroad in her new post. Asian markets closed down this morning on news that Japan's economy shrunk at its fastest rate in 35 years. And a Venezuelan vote ending term limits clears the way for Hugo Chavez to stay in office through the next decade and beyond.
He could be president for life. But the top story is Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, just arrived in Japan a couple of hours ago, already warning North Korea on nukes. She says it needs to live up to promises to dismantle its nuclear program. State Department official Christopher Hill is underscoring the message.
We do not and have never accepted North Korea as a nuclear weapons state. I want to make that very clear.
After today's visit to Japan, Hillary Clinton will be in China, South Korea, and Indonesia. Femi?
Apart from nuclear worries, the economy tops the Secretary of State's agenda. New numbers from Japan show the economy there shrinking by more than 12% on an annual basis. The report sent Asian markets tumbling. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez is celebrating victory today. Voters there ended term limits in a weekend referendum. Chavez can now run for another six-year term in 2012. And John, you mentioned this. There will be more than one person behind the wheel on the drive to fix the auto industry. It will take a full task force, not merely one so-called car czar. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner and White House Economic Advisor Lawrence Summers will lead it.
Are they a car junta then?
Very nice, yes. Junta, Junta? No, let's not start that debate. Tomorrow is the deadline for GM and Chrysler to submit plans on how they can repay billions in government loans. At least 30 people are dead in Pakistan's northwest after a suspected US missile strike. It's the latest in a series of attacks on the region that's been a hotbed for militant activity. And this comes amid news today that the government will impose Islamic law in the area in an effort to call down the Taliban fighters.
And also amid news that any day now, the Obama administration is possibly going to report a significant surge in troops in Afghanistan.
Right.
Coming up this hour, we'll explain why Hillary Clinton's first trip as Secretary of State is to Asia. And we'll also look at a controversial Pentagon program to bring immigrants into the military. The markets are closed as it is President's Day today. So if you use Facebook, you've probably seen the 25 random things, people posting long lists of details about their lives you may or may not know or care about. It's a huge viral phenomenon in the social networking world. But whether you use Facebook or shun it, we want to hear from you. What has someone told you about a friend, about themselves, a celebrity, political leader that you wish they hadn't? What's TMI, too much information? Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Also, hey, two random things about you.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We begin in Asia. Huge story in Japan. The Japanese government announced that its GDP, its gross domestic product, dropped at an annual pace of 12.7% in the last quarter of 2008. It's an enormously demoralizing statistic, far more than analysts expected. And in a sense, upstaged the arrival of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who is in Tokyo today on her trip to Asia. Her trip is both an indicator of how much the U.S. and Asia have at stake in this economic downturn and how much engage Asia in many respects is a priority for the new Obama administration. We spoke earlier to BBC diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus, and I asked Jonathan what this GDP report out of Japan means for the country as Hillary Clinton arrives in Tokyo.
Well, it's a hugely demoralizing statistic, and it really underscores the fact that obviously Asia and the West are locked together in this economic embrace, both being buffeted by the economic storms. And I think whilst the economy isn't perhaps the central issue for the Secretary of State, I think the Japanese will be looking for some reassurance from the Americans on the diplomatic front that their relationship with Washington won't simply be overshadowed by this much more fundamental relationship and with China, which is obviously going to be the last port of call on the Secretary of State's trip.
Well, and there was a signal of some reassurance, it seems to me, to China. Hillary Clinton talking about global warming being an opportunity for economic cooperation. She's going to visit some clean energy facility in Beijing. It seems as though the normal kind of human rights dialogue that has always been in a very sort of contentious back and forth between the U.S. and China is not the first order of business for Hillary Clinton, or am I wrong?
Well, I think she's still going to look at those issues, but I think what we are going to see is a rebalancing of the relationship with China. I think a fresh start. I think some of the ambivalence of the Bush years, the concerns about China, is it a partner or is it a potential rival? Certainly from what we've heard from Hillary Clinton over recent days, she sees China decidedly as a partner. It's clear that China is fast becoming the indispensable nation, if you want to call it that, a term that was often has been used about the United States. But if you look at all the vital transnational issues, the economy, dealing with proliferation, crucially global warming, it's clear that China, other countries in Asia as well, of course, but China is really the crucial player with a seat on the Security Council, this vast economy, despite some recent problems, it's going to be growing hugely in the future. And so China and the United States are locked together on a whole range of issues, and it's that partnership that the Secretary of State wants to pursue.
Well, the takeaway there is cooperation takes center stage. There's a visit to Indonesia and Korea also in the trip by Hillary Clinton, and we're going to check in with Jonathan again later in the week as the story of the Secretary of State in Asia develops. That was BBC diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus, who spoke with us from London in an interview early this morning. Joining us now is Glenn Thrush, senior congressional reporter for Politico. Forget stimulus, folks. Think about the political lessons from that passage late last week of the $787 billion stimulus bill. Okay, fine. There's money going out to states and localities for all sorts of things, including tax cuts. But it was mostly a reveal about how the Democrats are going to behave in the majority of both the House and the Senate, and how the GOP is going to behave as the opposition. Bipartisanship? Forget it. That's what Obama was hoping for, but it's not going to happen. Glenn Thrush, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
What do you think the political lessons for Barack Obama, let's start there, are?
Well, I think the main lesson is that the House Republicans, and to a large extent the Republicans on the Hill in general, are furniture to be avoided so that you don't bang your knee into as you walk around them. I think there's some element of bitterness in the White House about the way that they were shut out twice, not a single Republican vote in the House. And a growing tide of anger among congressional Democrats who really want Obama, really sort of daring Obama, to tell the Senate Republicans, go ahead, filibuster.
So, first of all, is this a result of dynamics within the Democratic Party, or is this because the GOP chose to behave more like, heavy couches and tough furniture that you really have to walk around rather than, responding to Obama's efforts to reach across the aisle? We heard so much about that.
50-50. I think in the House you've got Nancy Pelosi, who is a sharp-elbowed, very practiced partisan fighter. And you also have in the House a group of Republicans who are having a collective identity crisis. They've lost 40 to 50 seats in the last two election cycles. They are now a relatively small minority in the House without really a sense of mission. I don't know if you recall, right before the 111th Congress began, you were just seeing article after article, these almost sort of confessional memoir-type deals from congressional Republicans talking about what is the identity of our party. So to a very large extent, what happened this past week with the stimulus had less to do with Barack Obama and more to do with them sort of cohering around something, and that something is the word no.
The word no, right, exactly. So what does this mean for Harry Reid and Pelosi? They certainly didn't show themselves to be an organized, lockstep, marching band here. There was a lot of confusion, it seemed.
Well, what's that great Will Rogers line? I don't belong to any organized party. I'm a Democrat.
I think
the larger context, and Pelosi is right. Every time we have our weekly press conference up here on the Hill with Pelosi, we mention these things, and she says, hey guys, we just passed a nearly $800 billion stimulus package, and we already have wrapped up the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act and a bunch of other things. So the larger context is there is a degree of success, and in any of these, we don't remember the details of the passage of, for instance, the first 100 days of the New Deal, and there were battles back then as well. But that said, I think it's clear that Pelosi and Reid are going to have to learn how to communicate better with one another, and are going to have to learn from the Republicans a little bit about sticking to a single coherent message.
Well, that, I guess, is sort of my problem with the whole stimulus process. Even Obama, I think, could be faulted here. This doesn't seem like a policy bill. It seems like a kind of a hodgepodge. There isn't a strong central message of doing really important things for Americans that people are going to see. It seems much more a lot of different priorities, a lot of different agendas jammed into a huge, huge bill. And who knows what we're going to see when it actually starts getting implemented.
Well, that's the interesting part. I mean, most of the economists that I've there's been a lot of sort of every single day there seems to be a new story about what economists are saying about this thing. But by and large, the concept of stimulus, and this was a frustration expressed by Obama himself when he addressed the Democrats in Williamsburg about a week and a half ago. The very nature of a stimulus is to throw a lot of money out into the economy so that it is consumed and that people are employed as a result of that consumption. The very nature of a stimulus is helter-skelter. That's a little bit of this, a little bit of that. It's kind of a gumbo. I think you're absolutely right. I don't think Obama did a good enough job, at least in the initial phases, of letting people understand that the little bit of this, little bit of that approach is actually what a stimulus is about.
Finally, is Washington looking more like a parliamentary system as a result of this vote, where there really is just an opposition and it doesn't really figure into the negotiations on policy?
Well, I think to some extent it always is a parliamentary system. Within the Democratic caucus, you've got several groups that are now sort of maneuvering to apply pressure to Pelosi. Now, Pelosi has this huge margin in the House, and you have the Blue Dog Democrats, who are the conservative fiscal types. You also have progressives and liberals who really blew up in her face when Harry Reid tried to push this deal through with the Senate. So yes, I think you're going to see all these interesting little alignments. But I also think that this was a little bit of an outlier, that you're going to start seeing more Republicans as you move from sort of the prefix $787 billion to the a la carte of smaller items, like, for instance, the children's health care stuff. You're going to see more Republicans starting to leap into the Democrat column.
We didn't even get to the fact that Republicans actually overtly went after Roland Burris, the Democratic senator appointed by Rod Blagojevich, accusing him of quid pro quo. We don't have time to talk about that, but certainly that's on the table all of a sudden as the focus of the GOP. Glenn Thrush, senior congressional reporter for Politico, on the political lessons of the stimulus. There are many, and we're going to be living them over the next year. But 25 random things about yourself. Can you even come up with 25? 5 million Facebook users did. And the whole process of disclosing 25 random things about yourself is a viral phenomenon that we want you to participate in. We're going to be talking about it later on in the show. But tell us some random things about yourself, or maybe something you'd want to forget.
Tyrell from Baltimore once again. And it's almost always a case of too much information when it comes to that kind of stuff. I found that my friends were swingers of the worst type. The big, the fat, and the nasty. That was way, way too much in the tale and in picture.
There you go. Too much information. 25 random things. It's a phenomenon on Facebook. What do you think? At 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Well, for a whole lot of families in Luzerne County, Pennsylvania, this holiday weekend was a weekend of contemplating a real shocker that unfolded in that Pennsylvania community. In a story that was reported on this program and in the New York Times last week, New York Times reporter Ian Urbina laid out a scheme involving two judges, Mark Chivarella and Michael Conahan. And quite frankly, it's reminiscent of something Charles Dickens might have written about.
The two judges at hand pled guilty yesterday. They pled to having engaged in a scheme in which they initially set up a relationship between the courthouse and a project to build two detention centers. And then subsequently, they began essentially funneling the kids that they were sentencing to the centers, all for a hefty $2.6 million kickback.
That's Ian Urbina of the New York Times talking about those two judges, $2.6 million to deliberately sentence kids and juvenile offenders in the juvenile justice system in Luzerne County to detention in a facility that they had a specific financial interest in. Wow. Families all over Luzerne County are dealing with this in the aftermath of the unfolding of this story. Laureen and Hillary Transu, mother and daughter, join us from Whitehaven, Pennsylvania. Laureen, take us back to the moment when your daughter was sentenced by one of these judges and your shock at the sentence they received and your feelings now.
Well, at the time, it just was unbelievable. It didn't make sense to me. It actually took a few seconds for it to sink in, and then I just kind of fell apart. I couldn't imagine that they had just taken my daughter away in handcuffs, and couldn't understand, like, how something so unfair and so cold could be carried out on a child. And then to read in the papers and hear on the news and that the judge actually received money, got kickbacks to do this to children and to their families. I can't even find the words to express it. It's horrible. It's just horrific.
Did you come up with any explanation to yourself when the sentence was handed down? I mean, now, of course, it's just corruption. But what did you think at the time was going on?
At the time, I, based on the judge's attitude in the courtroom, the way he spoke to my daughter, the way the whole process was carried out, I really felt like it was kind of an arrogance on his part. In other words, he's the only juvenile justice judge that was hearing cases at that time, and I think he just had the power to do whatever he wanted. He told Hillary, he said, "You remember when I spoke at your school and said, if a kid comes before me, they'll be sent away." And he brought down the gavel and he says, "I mean what I said, take her away."
Hillary,
that was it.
Hillary, you're the teenager in the middle of all this. What's it feel like to have had your life derailed for what amounted to, you know, a couple of bucks for this judge?
It feels horrible, I guess, needless to say. It's kind of, you know, my life gets uprooted and, you know, what is it for? To line the pockets of some judge who's, you know, I was supposed to have faith in to, you know, carry out a sentence that was in my best interest.
We should mention, at least in general terms, what the offense was and the level of severity of the offense and then the sentence that you received. Could you lay out those details as far as you're comfortable?
Well,
go ahead, Hillary.
It was called harassment, but it was a misdemeanor, I guess, the third degree. It was for allegedly creating a MySpace about my assistant principal.
But the punishment you received, which is a detail I'm most interested in, what was that?
I received 3 months in a wilderness camp, and was then supposed to do 6 months of probation afterwards.
And for a year and a half after this sentence, you've been dealing with counseling and all sorts of aftermath. Does this decision or does this announcement that the judges received money, does it set you back in your rehab or does it actually help you find closure?
I would say that it helps me find closure because now I have a legitimate reason. I know why this was going on. It wasn't because I'm necessarily did anything wrong legally. It's because, you know, some guy was making money off of it, and not because necessarily that, you know, I'm a bad kid or something.
Well, it sounds like you've learned a lot of lessons, and maybe you should be speaking at the school assembly next time around. Lorene, before we go, you know, the irony here is that the juvenile justice system is actually supposed to have rehab and, you know, help for young kids at the heart of its core values. This got totally tossed out the window.
That's true. And also you have to understand that my daughter and many, many of the parents and children that we've now kind of networked with is that the offenses were completely minor. I mean, what Hillary was charged with was basically drawing a funny picture of her assistant principal.
Wow.
That was what happened. Another child I know ran away from home at 14 years old.
But as you say, Lorene,
another child actually cut school for the day. I mean, who has not cut school?
So mothers and fathers and families all over Luzerne County are talking about, you know, what does this mean?
Oh,
this is a huge story.
It is a huge story. And I think we have to remember that not only does this affect a child, but it affects their parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles, cousins, friends. I mean, each child, you know, they're at the center of a family. And when the judge sentences this child, they're sentencing a family to be without their child. I think it's interesting, though, that the judge had two lawyers. He has plenty of time out between when the charges were brought, the arraignment, the sentencing, and was getting paid for part of that time. But when your child is sentenced, the whole thing happens at once. They're arraigned, they have the hearing, they have the sentence, all in 60 seconds, and they're taken away, and you can't even say goodbye.
Wow.
There's not even a hug goodbye. They're just gone.
Well, Lorene, we are grateful that Hillary, at least in this interview, suggests that this gives her a little bit of closure. But just imagine the scars, potentially permanent, of all the kids that were sentenced by these judges and for a paltry $2.6 million. Lorene and Hillary, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us on. We appreciate you giving us a voice.
Good luck, Hillary. Lorene and Hillary Transu, mother and daughter, two victims of a scheme which funneled defendants from the juvenile justice system in Luzerne County, Pennsylvania, to specific detention centers, and the judges were given kickbacks of $2.6 million. Originally reported in the New York Times, reporter Ian Urbina laid it out on this program last Friday. We talked with two victims this morning.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. In a moment, a discussion of a pilot program by the Pentagon to deal with some problems of the volunteer army in this economic downturn time. But first, the headlines from Femi Okay.
Hello there. The time is 28 minutes to the top of the hour. The job of car czar is no longer on the market. The White House believes that fixing the car business is too big a job for one person. Now a full presidential committee will direct restructuring. The Treasury Secretary and National Economic Council Director will oversee it. Tomorrow is the deadline for GM and Chrysler to show how they can repay billions in government loans. The president heads to Denver tomorrow to sign the $787 billion economic stimulus bill into law. On Wednesday, he'll be in Phoenix, where he's expected to offer help to homeowners on the brink of foreclosure. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez now has the opportunity to run for president as many times as he likes. A referendum to eliminate presidential term limits passed yesterday with 54% of the vote. And Chavez has said that he needs another 10 years in office to make a real difference. And Shiite pilgrims returning to Baghdad today were hit by two roadside bombs that killed at least 8 and wounded dozens more. And it's the latest in a series of attacks on pilgrims visiting Karbala. That's a look at some of the top stories from this morning. John.
Thank you, Femi. As I mentioned at the top here, times may be better for U.S. military recruiters. With unemployment way up, recruiters are potentially looking at a much bigger pool of applicants, applicants who think of the military as suddenly an option as the Iraq conflict winds down and unemployment moves up. The Pentagon is trying out a new pilot program to begin recruiting skilled immigrants with the offer of citizenship in exchange for 3 or 4 years of military service. According to this pilot program, they're being picky about whom they pick, especially focusing on people with multiple language facility. Julia Preston joins us. Julia is a national immigration correspondent with the New York Times. This is a pretty interesting program, Julia, that appears to address some traditional deficits, at least as far as language is concerned in the military, particularly Arabic languages. Is this pilot program just for the Army?
No, this is going to be for all of the services. The Army is leading the pilot program.
I see.
They're looking for people that have skills in Arabic, Chinese, Korean, a series of 35 languages that have proven to be hard to find in military recruits.
And do they think they're going to be able to get this expertise by offering citizenship? They're competing with people who may be of interest in the job market.
Well, they're reaching out to a particular group of immigrants, which are immigrants who are here on temporary visas. This is a new thing for the military in this period of war. These are people who are here not as legal permanent residents, people with green cards, but a different kind of visa. And those people often, when they come, have to declare that they're not interested in staying in the United States permanently. And the path to citizenship for those people can be very long, 15 years, 10 years. So the idea that they could become citizens in 6 months is very appealing to some of these people.
Now, is the offer also with the understanding that perhaps these people would be more likely to be in intelligence jobs rather than direct combat situations?
There's no understanding like that. This is a standard recruitment, a standard enlistment. They are looking for a particular kind of skill that does not necessarily involve combat. But there is no understanding at all that they would not be going into a war situation.
Now, on the one hand, you could look at this program as being a sign of some real strategic thoughtfulness on the part of the Pentagon to look ahead for conflicts in the future and to try to identify a pool of people who could satisfy the requirements. Or it could just be another sign of desperation on the part of the military, which has seen recruitment decline. Which do you think it is here?
Well, I don't think it's desperation, but it is a recognition that there are real difficulties for a volunteer army to continue to recruit people who have a high level of skills. Very often, people who, Americans who attempt to enlist, don't meet the standards. You have to have a high school diploma or a GED. And the Army, for example, is continuing to provide waivers for criminal records, that kind of thing, to about 18% of the people who enlist currently. And so this is a recognition that it's a reaching out to create a much broader pool of skilled people for enlistment.
And the Army describes this pool as how large? Do you know?
Well, the goal is possibly to reach as many as 14,000 recruits for the Army annually. Currently, the Army's recruiting about 80,000 recruits annually, so that would be about 1 in 6. It would be a very large group of soldiers that the Army's looking at for this.
And they need to be able to speak English, right?
Yes.
It's not as though they're going to be Chinese-only or Arabic-only
boot camps. No, that's right. But they need to demonstrate proficiency in both languages and pass the regular tests. But this is, on average, a highly educated group of people. Many of them are some of the visas that they have require advanced degrees or advanced education. And so this is going to be a much more skilled group of people than the average Americans that apply.
Now, finally, this hasn't really been done for temporary immigrants since the Vietnam era. What has been the success of these kinds of programs in the past, or are they not really comparable?
Well, it's not really comparable to Vietnam, for example, because, among other things, obviously we had a draft at that time.
Sure.
Although an interesting detail is that all immigrants in the United States are required to sign up for the Selective Service.
Is that right?
Yes.
You have
even
to have
if
a
you're
draft
an illegal immigrant.
Even if you're an illegal immigrant,
yes,
you have to have a draft
you
card?
You must sign up for the Selective Service. So the difference in what's happening now is, of course, we're on a wartime status, and the wartime authority gives the Pentagon the possibility of recruiting all kinds of immigrants.
Sure.
They could, in fact, recruit illegal immigrants now, but they don't, as a matter of policy.
Last question. Is this a big story in immigrant communities around the United States?
Yes.
Or here in the New York area? Really?
Yes.
I mean, it's being covered, and what's the sense? This is a great idea? This is a wonderful thing?
It's a possibility for citizenship for people that might have had to wait a decade or more, or might never get to be citizens.
A possibility for immigrants all over the United States is part of a pilot program, an exciting, potentially interesting path to citizenship for thousands of immigrants, an interesting reveal of policy in the Obama Pentagon. I'd like to thank my guest, Julia Preston of The New York Times, for joining us. She is the national immigration correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. So later this hour, we're going to be talking about that web post, 25 Random Things About Me. It's a Facebook phenomenon. People post long lists of details about their lives that you may or may not know. What do you think? Lisa says on our website, I'm a pretty avid Facebook user, but something about this seems self-centered and generic. Frankly, I don't have the time to consider 25 things that I would want Facebook friends, ranging from acquaintances to close family members, to know about myself. My close relations already know plenty of random things about me, and I don't feel compelled to confess, brag, or otherwise share with 25 people. If I want someone to know something about me, I should get together with them and discuss it. You know, the time for all of this is a mystery to me. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. So the fourth anniversary of the assassination of former Prime Minister of Lebanon, Rafik Hariri, is an important day of remembrance for the people of Lebanon, who after that assassination saw a period of violence culminating with a war with Israel. This comes just 2 weeks before a United Nations tribunal into the killing is to begin. We're joined now by Natalia Antalava, BBC Beirut correspondent in Beirut. The two surprising things is it seems that the 4 years have kind of crept up on us. I was actually surprised to learn it was 4 years ago that Rafik Hariri was assassinated. And the second thing is that we haven't gotten to the bottom of who actually is behind this assassination. Natalia, what are people on the streets of Beirut thinking?
Well, I think probably many people share the same sentiment, how fast these 4 years have gone by. At the same time, this have been extremely long 4 years for Lebanon, much trouble, a war, serious civil unrests, and now the upcoming parliamentary election, which in many ways will decide Lebanon's future. And of course, for the people who gathered to remember Rafik Hariri, many of them were saying that they still have questions that have not been answered and they still are waiting for justice. It was an absolutely, it was a landmark moment in Lebanon's history. It changed the course of its history, really. And the killing was blamed here on Syria, forced Syria to pull out its troops because of the public outcry that it caused. But the big question now is whether the perpetrators and those who executed the crime will be punished.
Well, as you mentioned, it was a transformative moment for Lebanon. And this weekend, hundreds of thousands of Lebanese were on the streets to mark that transformative moment. You mentioned that the Syrians ultimately withdrew from Lebanon in the aftermath of this event. What other transformative events can be traced to this assassination within the Lebanese government?
Well, I think there are two things that are worth pointing out. One was what started as a Syrian withdrawal, because right after the assassination, we saw a huge protests and an amazing public outcry. And combined with the international pressure, it forced Syria to withdraw. To end its 30-year-long domination of Lebanon was a big blow for Damascus, obviously, but they had to do it. Now, today, it's incredible to see just how much things have changed, because for the first time ever, Lebanon and Syria are establishing diplomatic ties. And when over the weekend I talked to the son and the political heir of Rafik Hariri, Saad Hariri, he was telling me that he's proud that now the two countries are talking as equals. So that's one main thing. And I think the other thing is, although there's still no love lost in it, there's absolutely it's a relationship that is full of mistrust and animosity, but at least it's a relationship of equals. And another thing is that the political parties are finally talking here. The politicians, rival politicians who are bitterly opposed to each other, are holding a very fragile but still a dialogue. And the big question is whether the parliamentary election in June that is coming up, whether this dialogue will actually survive the campaign and will be
Indeed.
Able to continue afterwards.
Well, Natalia Antileva, whether there is a specific link to Syria or not, certainly political optimism there in Lebanon. Natalia Antileva is the BBC Beirut correspondent speaking to us from Beirut.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. So in the last few days, 5 million Facebook users sent out 25 million random things about themselves. That's 125 million bits of random information. That's too much information all by itself. We're going to talk about the phenomenon and your reaction to it in just a moment. But first, headlines from Femi, okay?
Hello there. 13 minutes to the top of the hour. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is on her first trip abroad in her new office. She's in Japan today and will also visit Indonesia, South Korea and China on her Asian swing. She's already spoken out about nuclear issues in North Korea, demanding the country keep promises to dismantle its nuclear program. China has a problem with stimulus packages in several Western countries. It's complaining that they are protectionist and that it will worsen the financial crisis. A commentary in the official China news agency over the weekend singled out the Buy American provision in the US plan. The bill's requirements that infrastructure projects use domestic materials were softened after strong criticism from overseas. New numbers from Japan show that the economy there is shrinking by more than 12% on an annual basis. That's the fastest drop in 35 years and more than triple the recent drop in the US economy. And the report was worse than analysts expected, and it sent Asian markets down. And there's been another reported missile attack in the northwest tribal area of Pakistan by an unmanned American aircraft. It's the second since the weekend. And finally, it's a Texas mystery. Jim Havener was playing golf in Texas when something strange lit up the sky.
It was like a real bright ball that had an elongated goldish tail on it, and it surprised me because it lasted, I would say, 3 or 4 seconds in the sky, and then it went out just before it got to the tree line.
For heaven's sakes, sounds like a meteor.
Scary.
Well, what is it?
Unidentified flying object, John.
That's not connected to the two satellites colliding.
It is not. In fact, the Federal Aviation Administration said it had nothing to do with that, and they don't know what it is.
Thank you, Femi. As I mentioned before, a viral infestation on the online social networking world is actually causing no problems for anyone except for our next guest. Scott Lamb joins us now, senior editor of BuzzFeed.com, who has posted on our website the 8 things I wish I didn't know, a direct response to the fact that between January 26th and February 2nd, Facebook users sent out 5 million of 25 random things about themselves that they want others to know. 125 million random things? Well, Scott Lamb is not thrilled. And Scott, let's just talk first about the phenomenon itself. It's a huge application on Facebook, and it seems to have really struck a chord in the networking community.
Yeah, it's kind of Facebook's biggest mainstream success, their real crossover. And, you know, the number of users on Facebook went up dramatically in January. And since the beginning of February, they've more than doubled the number of people posting notes, largely because of this. It's sort of the first thing that's really hit with the mainstream.
And is this really something that encourages people to unburden themselves about real details about their life? Or is it more lies and manipulation?
I'd say it's a mixed bag. Yeah. I mean, some people definitely want to look at it ironically. I think a lot of people, it's kind of like we've been subjected to this massive creative writing exercise. It's suddenly it's like journaling for people. And they want to share, but they also are, I think, very cagey about what it is they're going to share on something like a social network.
Well, we've had you posting on our website, thetakeaway.org, and you're, of course, posting all the time on BuzzFeed. We asked people what their response to all this is, and someone called P emailed us and said, "I don't understand this tendency to feel that you should expose the details, lurid or not, of your life to the public. I belong to Facebook and have nothing of a personal nature posted there, not even a photo." Then kind of why be on Facebook, right? "The less strangers know about you, the better, but tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We asked for too much information, people getting information that they wish they could forget. Here's what one of our listeners said.
"Good morning, John. I just wanted to let you know that I learned through 25 things on Facebook that my mother is actually my sister, and I thought that wasn't the nicest way to find that out."
That's pretty good, although I don't believe that for a moment. You know, you have kind of a snarky response to 25 things, so give me a couple of the things that you and I think some of these are probably true.
Well, I wanted to have a place to, A, put some of the things that I'd learned from other people and kind of get them out of my head.
Right.
Some of them are actually things that I had experienced myself. You know, the sound of a body falling from a great height. No one wants to know about that.
Right.
But it was through the 25 things that I learned about eye worms, which is something I really wish that I could unlearn.
Right. "I use Rogaine, but not even real Rogaine. It's Costco Rogaine, which makes it even sadder." That's not real, but it's kind of it's sort of a send-up of the kinds of things that you see on these lists.
Yeah, I think that people want to share something that seems revealing about themselves, but also is actually it's charming and it's meant to be a joke.
Maybe a little less charming. "I'm a pretty good shoplifter. Are you?"
I'm a fairly adept shoplifter. Yes, not something I'm proud of, but it's a skill that comes in handy from time to time.
What do you think the motivation is to unburden yourself like this? Is it candor? Is it just playing around? Is it being published?
I have a hard time at this point in the culture believing that it's just candor. I mean, people see so many things going on Facebook. So many scandals have happened on Facebook. I think that it's usually some sort of seductive element that people want people to like them or respond to something in them. I don't just think it's unburdening and journaling online.
Mm-hmm. So what explains the popularity?
I think it was just a kind of a perfect storm. You know, Facebook grew a lot during that period. They also, this tagging feature that they have in Notes is really nice for spreading things in a viral way. The whole framework of 25 things, you know, you tag 25 people and then they are under some sort of social pressure to go ahead and respond to what you've said. And I think that worked out really well for creating, a nice viral meme.
Well, what 8 things do you wish you didn't know that either come from friends of yours or are just, you know, sort of out there in the ether?
There were some people's sexual histories that I kind of wish that I hadn't learned about via Facebook. It seemed like a very weird way to enter into that sort of next level with them. Also, I learned some sad things about people's family history, which I also felt uncomfortable knowing because I could only bring up in the context of having read it on Facebook.
Although, you know, in that sense, it may be useful to have Facebook to give information out like that because, when people suffer terrible tragedies in their family, the people that learn about it sort of in face-to-face encounters, did you know my mother died or something like that,
yeah.
They're actually reliving the event. I mean, Facebook seems to me to be a way for people to get the information out in a way that isn't traumatic for the victim, but, you know, certainly informs people in the way they need to be informed.
Now, that's certainly true. And the defenses that I've seen of 25 Things have kind of gone along that line, that there's actually, you can learn intimate information that sometimes is difficult to convey face to face.
Joel Stein writes on his random things that he's sort of conveying. Until fifth grade, I thought rock and roll music was evil. I was not religious or Christian, just a massive nerd. 3, I've never read a comic book. There is something confessional about these sort of satirical ones, in the sense that you're kind of telling people interesting facts that maybe you think are interesting about yourself.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the problem.
I think that is kind of the problem that we, most of us, I think myself included, aren't really that adept at figuring out what the interesting things about us are. You know, everyone has called this TMI. It's kind of TMBI. It's too much boring information. These things occasionally are really interesting.
So what crosses the threshold for you? What do you really want to know?
I mean, I do kind of want to know if these are people that are kind of acquaintances of mine. They're really deep and interesting things about them that they haven't shared. But those aren't usually the random things they share. They're usually kind of funny and jokey.
So you want them to call you up on your cell phone and tell you some, Scott, I've always really wanted to take you to this beachside resort and that sort of
thing. That would be nice, yes. I'd like a lot of – anyone can do that, actually.
And on our website, Scott, you've posted the 8 things I wish I didn't know, which is on this craze of 25 things. Scott Lamb, senior editor at BuzzFeed.com. Thanks so much for joining us and not being boring. Go to our website, thetakeaway.org. You can read more of what Scott says. And while you're there, there's a great conversation going on about this 25 things and the phenomenon of disclosing information, boring or not, about yourself. Tomorrow writes on our site, seems like all the articles about this web post and about Facebook being more for parents of MySpace users just pushes the idea of getting everyone online. Maybe it's a marketing ploy, Tamara says. So 25 random things was the icebreaker for her. One random thing about me, I cry during the Star Spangled Banner. Thank you for sharing, Tamara. Kim says, I think the 25 random things is something people do when they feel like they don't have anything real to say. What makes this spread is the fact that you tag more friends, and when you post your list and those friends have to respond next, the people on my Facebook who really know me know all those things already. What do you think? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Here's your takeaway.
The very nature of a stimulus is helter-skelter. That's a little bit of this, a little bit of that. It's kind of a gumbo.
Recipe or political lessons from the stimulus package. That's Glenn Thrush, senior congressional reporter for Politico.com. Always take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or iTunes. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
First, it was New York's Michael Bloomberg. Now, Venezuela's Hugo Chavez. Terms unlimited?
I am ready. With today's victory, we start the third historical cycle of the Bolivarian Revolution.
My whole life has prepared me for the challenges ahead, and I want to give the voters a chance to decide if they want me at the helm.
Who would have thought Hugo Chavez would be a political student of Mayor Bloomberg of New York? Chavez could be president for life after a weekend referendum removed any limits on his being president. The student becomes the master. Heady times for Hugo on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is away. Femi Oke is here. What do we need to be thinking about today, Femi?
Hello there, John. Good morning, all. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Japan right now on her first overseas trip in her official role. Asian markets closed down this morning on news that Japan's economy shrunk at its fastest rate in 35 years. And President Obama believes fixing the auto industry's too big a job for single car czar. The White House now says that he will appoint a full task force.
Thank you, Femi. We begin in Asia. Yes, it's the name of a terrible, forgettable band, but an important, crucial continent. And Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, is probably thinking more about the continent than the band this week. She's in Asia. Economics, security, and human rights will be all on the table. After today's visit to Japan, Hillary Clinton will be in China, South Korea, and Indonesia. That's the top story. Femi?
Hello there, John. Staying again in Asia, and that is where we're actually seeing that we've got some new numbers out of Japan. The economy is shrinking by more than 12% on an annual basis, and the report pushed Asian markets down this morning. One car czar, not enough to fix the American auto business. At least that's what the president believes now. The White House says that the industry needs a full task force. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner and White House Economic Advisor Lawrence Summers are in the line to lead it. And as John, you mentioned this earlier, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez is celebrating victory today. Now, voters there ended term limits in a weekend referendum, but many protesters want Chavez out, like John Serle. He was speaking to Sky News.
Why may not we march? We may protest. We have the right to protest against him. Most of us hate him because he's a communist dictator.
Chavez can now run for another six-year term in 2012, and we'll have more on this in a conversation about Venezuela later this hour. At least 30 people are dead in Pakistan's northwest after a suspected U.S. missile strike. It's the latest in a series of attacks on the region that's a hotbed for militant activity. And this comes amid news today that the government will impose Islamic law in that region in an effort to cool down Taliban fighters.
Thank you, Femi. Wall Street is closed for the President's Day holiday coming up this hour. There's a deadline for car makers coming up. We're going to explain that. And rebuilding the economy with fiberboard and Allen wrenches. Do it yourself. Ever assembled something that you bought to maybe save money? Well, not only does it save money, it actually adds value to the item. Our friend Dan Ariely brings us the story this hour. He talks about the IKEA effect. Is it something in your experience? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Stories of triumph and tragedy when you do it yourself.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. On this holiday, President's Day Monday, we're thinking about the impulse to do it yourself, to assemble something that you've bought, perhaps to save money. Is it a possible response to the recession? Later on in the program, our friend Dan Ariely from Duke University is going to talk about something called the IKEA effect, adding value when you put it together yourself. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Add your story to the mix. Well, the auto industry, speaking of DIY, is trying to reassemble itself, and it's facing a really big deadline this week.
We need an auto industry in this country. There are millions of lives, livelihoods that depend on it, not just at the auto companies, but spin-off manufacturers, dealers, and so on. So we have a real interest in seeing the auto industry survive. But it's going to require a major restructuring.
It's David Axelrod, senior advisor to President Obama on Meet the Press yesterday. GM and Chrysler's deadline comes tomorrow. They have to submit new restructuring plans under a $17.4 billion federal bailout. Steps to cut excess workers, close surplus factories. They're expected to be part of the plans. And those companies in the UAW have been talking all about what's going to be in those agreements that are going to be submitted to the government. Meanwhile, the big news today is that the Obama administration has stepped away from the idea of appointing a car czar. Instead, there will be a presidential panel to oversee the auto industry, and Timothy Geithner at the Treasury Secretary, or at the Department of the Treasury, is going to be overseeing the details of the auto industry bailout. Justin Hyde, reporter for the Detroit Free Press, joins us from Washington. I imagine in Detroit, there's a lot of interest in this deadline and what's going on in Washington. First of all, if there's no car czar, does this suggest that the Obama administration believes things are well in hand?
It's unclear. I think that given the scope of the panel that the Obama administration is setting up, I think they believe it's going to take a lot of energy to and attention to get the industry back to where it needs to be. We're not really clear on exactly how big this panel is, but it's going to be drawing people from several different agencies, transportation, labor, EPA, and Treasury. The restructuring plan that GM and Chrysler are going to submit may take a couple of years to put into effect, and it's not clear exactly how much more money they might ask the government for.
Well, Justin Hyde, let's think for a moment about what could be in this plan that's submitted on Tuesday that could really be a non-starter. We certainly saw auto executives come to Washington the first time they were pleading for some sort of federal bailout and really returning with hats in hand from, you know, private jets and notions of executive pay. What is it that could be in this agreement that would really, put the government on notice that maybe things aren't going to work out?
Well, there could be the issue of bankruptcy. There's been some reports that GM might consider bankruptcy. Chrysler has said bankruptcy won't be an option, but there are a lot of outside experts and analysts, even in Detroit, who believe that the market has shrunk down so much that Chrysler simply won't be able to prove that it's viable. If there is some deeper cut into union benefits, into retiree and health care benefits proposed by this deal, that might make it politically difficult. And remember, the Obama administration, in addition to wanting the industry to recover, also wants to see it build more fuel-efficient vehicles. If there's some issue where the industry suggests it might be difficult to meet some of those goals, those could cause some political ripples in Washington as well.
Now, it seems like the interests are radically different for GM and Chrysler in the sense that the Chrysler bailout, Cerberus, the owner of Chrysler, it seems to me, is in a position where it really can't go to bankruptcy because the value of all of its equity in Chrysler goes to zero, whereas bankruptcy might actually be a refuge for General Motors, even though they've complained about it for so long.
Well, it's pretty clear that no matter what Cerberus does, it's going to see its equity shrink, if not disappear, in Chrysler. Even if it doesn't go to bankruptcy, it's on the hook to give that equity to the union, to the bondholders, who are sitting there now at being asked for concessions. It's going to have to swap that equity out. The same is true for GM. It would still be in control if it stays out of bankruptcy, but it's going to have to give new equity to bondholders and the UAW as well. I think the issue of bankruptcy is when it was first proposed back in December, there was a great concern that it would be calamitous and things would basically fall apart in the industry, not just at GM and Chrysler, but perhaps at Ford. There may be a situation now that people can imagine a way to put a company like this into bankruptcy and any knock-on effects, but it's very unclear. There's never been a major automotive bankruptcy. We have no clue how it would affect thousands of suppliers, dealers, the unions, and other people up and down the chain.
Yeah, and on that question of bankruptcy, perhaps it is the UAW which really holds the cards here, and the indication of what concessions the UAW is ready to give to prevent bankruptcy or maybe to assist the companies to go into bankruptcy, that will be certainly something that everyone's going to be looking at. Justin Hyde, reporter for the Detroit Free Press, thanks so much for joining us. He's in the Washington Bureau there reporting on the deadline on Tuesday for General Motors and Chrysler to submit their restructuring plans to show how they plan to use the money that the federal government gave to them, more than $17 billion. Now, $17 billion used to be a lot of money, but now that the stimulus package has been passed, $787 billion finds its way to states and localities, a good portion of which will be for infrastructure projects. Neil King Jr., Washington reporter for the Wall Street Journal, joins us now to remind us of the serpentine regulatory pathway for some of these projects that actually may end up standing in the way of the spending of the stimulus package. Neil, let's talk about environmental and energy projects, which, you know, it's easy to create a blueprint for something like this, but getting it through all the regulatory loopholes could take years. What obstacles are in the path of the stimulus plan as you see it?
Quite a few, actually. I mean, if you look at the money that's set aside in the stimulus package, there's about $170 billion that's for spending on things, on infrastructure-related things. $40 billion or so of that is going to go through the Department of Energy, which has had real difficulties over recent years in getting money out. Particularly, we took a look at a recent story at their big loan guarantee program, which was something that was launched under the Bush administration. It was, let's get some loan guarantees out to these kind of upstart companies that are going to be doing interesting things on the environmental front. And 3 years down the road, the companies that had lined up that have jumped through unbelievable hoops in terms of environmental protection investigations, just making sure that everything was fine to go forward on that, all the financial regulatory things that they had to look at, et cetera, they still have dozens of hoops to jump through before any of these loan guarantees might go forward. So in the stimulus package, they're now planning to heap another $7 or $8 billion in loan guarantees on top of a program that's already foundering somewhat. Of course, in this case, with the emphasis on speed and getting things out the door so that jobs can be created or saved and work can be gotten underway, and it's going to be a kind of collision that we're going to see, I think, in a number of agencies where the push for speed is going to hit what is, for better or worse, obviously the sort of slow and deliberative process of the federal government when it comes to contracting, oversight, et cetera. So it's going to be difficult. Some of these pipelines that have been typically used to move, you know, $20 or $30 million a year are suddenly going to be asked to move billions of dollars a year.
Well, let's talk about that in specific cases. I mean, you mentioned the loan guarantee program, which is a relatively unambitious program of working with existing companies. If you're talking about creating, say, a nuclear power plant or major restructuring of the power grid that's going to involve building, I mean, you start right away with environmental impact statements, and those imply years of delays right off the top. Is that what we're looking at?
Well, there's a real concern about that. You just look at some of the big infrastructure projects that are already underway that take years, especially if they're multi-state, multi-jurisdictional. You have massive amounts of review that have to go on, obviously public hearings, all that kind of thing. The idea that all of a sudden, just because the economy is sour, we're going to be able to move billions of dollars and just sort of push these various hearings and the like out of the way. It's one thing to do that sort of thing, you know, after the earthquake in San Francisco when they went ahead and rebuilt some of the bridges and, played with the contracting or some of the environmental aspects that would otherwise have been there and made that thing really happen, or in the wake of Katrina, which is actually not a very good example of money moving well or quickly. But there are ways to do it, but it's differently to do it nationwide.
Well, let's look at the Commerce Department quickly before we go. There is a tradition of fast-tracking certain trade agreements so that they don't have to go through the deliberative process in the Senate. Is there any way to fast-track infrastructure projects without major congressional legislation?
Not really, no. I mean, it's there's talk about trying to do that, and I think that's going to be a big debate going forward in the next couple of weeks as to whether they can modulate some of these things or fudge it a little bit. But no, they're not going to be able to do it in some massive manner.
Well, there's a takeaway. No fast tracking. Neil King reminds us of all the obstacles standing in the way of $787 billion of real stimulus. They've got the money, but how are they going to spend it? Thanks for joining us, Neil. Neil King Jr. is a Washington-based reporter for the Wall Street Journal.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Buying something and assembling it yourself may save money, but does it also add value in the sense that your relationship to the object is somehow more deep, more valuable? Is there added value to doing it yourself? Is DIY a prescription in these hard economic times? Our friend Dan Ariely is going to bring us that story this hour, but we want to hear your triumphs and tragedies in the DIY world. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. IKEA horror stories and joys. Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. So President Obama is going to sign the $787 billion stimulus bill in Denver tomorrow. But even before the money starts flowing out, it's expected to set off a lot of fights between governors and legislators in state capitals and city halls, but especially between state governments and the federal government. The money that was taken out of the bill could have gone to close the fiscal gap in states around the United States, which suggests that in theory, maybe you get your tax relief from the federal government, but already states are talking about raising taxes to make up for their own fiscal problems. Joining us to talk about the fight between states and the federal government as stimulus gets spent in the United States is Monica Davey, Chicago bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. She joins us from Chicago. Monica, thanks for joining us.
Glad to do it.
I mean, already in New York, you have the prospect of higher taxes to cover a budget shortfall in New York. But this battle is much more political, state to state, project to project. What did the states lose here? And what do they think they can get back by a political battle?
Well, I think what they're looking at is, in many ways, this money has already been, much of the money has already sort of decided where it's going to go. So there's, in many ways, there isn't all that much to fight about. But then on some other levels, looking at road projects, bridge projects, and so forth, the states have a lot of decisions to make, and they're all lining up with lists, and I suspect that those lists are going to be far longer than the number of dollars there is to spend.
So if you're a governor around the United States and you look at this stimulus package and see what was taken out of it, I mean, really anything that involved discretionary funds that went to the governors where they could decide where to deploy it, you know, aside from the infrastructure projects you referred to a moment ago, all that was taken out. Does that play as a slap in the face to governors around the United States and that the federal government doesn't trust them with the money from the federal treasury?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure that all of them look at it that way. I think that they do have some decisions to make here. Again, even on the flows of money that are going to certain areas, local governments and states are still going to have some decisions to make. And even when it comes to things like Medicaid dollars, education dollars, they still get to make those individual decisions about where that money goes. So I'm not sure we could say in a blanket way what all the governors thought of the final bill, but I think that you're looking at states, it's important to remember, that are, for the most part, struggling with enormous deficits and facing, writing a new budget and trying to figure out what to do. So I think that much of this money is really welcome to them at this point.
Is there any sort of federal guideline as to how the decision will be made, whether, say, in New Jersey, a particular bridge is repaired or a new project is begun in a place like South Carolina?
There are rules, of course, about whether a project is considered shovel-ready. So, in other words, you can't dream up a project today that you'd like to build and not have the engineering done, not be ready to go ahead and build it. So, really, the projects that are already sort of lined up and ready to go are the ones that are going to get priority here. But again, in many states, there are a lot of those projects. So, people have to decide which win and which lose.
Now, South Carolina's Governor Mark Sanford says he's going to refuse the money. You talked a moment ago about certain federal guidelines for spending. The suggestion in South Carolina is that it would cost more for that state to actually take the money and use it for infrastructure projects than to try to go it alone. Is he unique in his response to this stimulus package?
I think it's an interesting problem for the governors who oppose elements of this stimulus plan. On the one hand, they have philosophical and practical reasons why they are against it. On the other hand, I think it's a tough political road to go down to turn away this money. So I don't think he's alone, but I think he's got a difficult road ahead here.
I mean, in a sense, the GOP governors can't do what the House and Senate did, and that was, you know, walk away from this completely and make it a Democrat-only proposal. They're much more under pressure to actually take this money. Is there a particular governor who's really pressured to take it based on the Republican governor, based on the economic climate in their state?
Well, I think if you look at the economic climate in most states, there's a lot of pressure to take any help that anyone can get. I know there are a few states that aren't in such dire trouble, but in many states with Republican and Democratic governors, the budgets simply look too bad. And I think, again, it's a politically difficult thing to do, to walk away from this money when residents understand that they're facing major cuts from services, deficits, the potential of raising taxes. I think that it's tough to walk away from federal money when other states won't.
Certainly a dilemma for Republican governors, and plenty of political battles ahead, even for Democratic governors attempting to get the most from this stimulus money, which starts its way to states and localities after the signing of the bill, expected on Tuesday in Denver. Barack Obama will be there. Monica Davey, Chicago Bureau Chief for our partners at The New York Times, joined us from Chicago. Thanks for that, Monica. And now headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much. 28 minutes past the hour. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is now in Tokyo. This is her first overseas trip in her new post, and the tour will also include stops in China, South Korea, and Indonesia. And it's the first time since the 1960s that Asia has been the first stop for a new Secretary of State. And while Secretary Clinton is just beginning her trip, the special envoy to Pakistan and Afghanistan is on the last leg of his. Richard Holbrooke says that he's glad President Hamid Karzai reaffirmed his support for an August election day.
We stated our strong belief that the Electoral Commission's decision to have the election on August 20th was appropriate in the context of the conditions in Afghanistan today.
Today, Richard Holbrooke is in New Delhi for talks with Indian leaders. A key topic is their relationship with Pakistan after the November terrorist attacks in Mumbai. Pakistan's government has agreed to impose Islamic law in a large part of the country's northwest. This is the region bordering Afghanistan, and it's a hotbed for militancy. The deal on Islamic law is part of a peace deal with the Taliban. Pakistan hopes that Islamic law will pacify Taliban fighters. And Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner spent the weekend explaining the revised financial bailout plan to the group of seven major industrial countries, and many expressed support for the program at the Rome meeting.
Unlike what happened in Congress last week. That's right.
Exactly.
Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I am ready with today's victory. We start the third historical cycle of the Bolivarian Revolution from 2009 to 2019.
That's Hugo Chavez, president of Venezuela, basically suggesting 10 more years. His revolution, his presidency, could be extended by at least that much, because 54% of the people of Venezuela have allowed him to return for a third term in office, the referendum over the weekend. His term expires in 2012. But he was term limited as a result of the referendum. He is no longer. So could Venezuela have a president for life? We posed that question to James Painter in London, Latin American analyst for the BBC World Service. In our conversation earlier this morning, I suggested that although on the one hand, this is a sign that Chavez's power is secure in Latin America, it's also true that many Latin American analysts wonder if Chavez isn't better off quitting while he's ahead.
That's certainly true. This victory yesterday was larger than expected. It was actually 8 percentage points. So you could argue that his power is fairly well consolidated for the years to come. But on the other hand, as you suggest, it's going to be a much more difficult period for him in the coming months, basically because of the price of oil. The budget last year was set at $60 a barrel. It's now $40 a barrel. He's going to have much more difficulty maintaining his popularity when he has much less oil money to spend on social programs.
James, what is this socialist revolution of Venezuela that he refers to? Is it more than just more of me, Hugo, your beloved president?
Well, he would, of course, argue it's much more than just me. He would say that he's delivered, and I think most people would agree that he has delivered, real reductions in poverty and absolute poverty and income inequality to the Venezuelan poor. Of course, his opponents would argue that this means more of Chavez, the autocrat. That's to say, even though there have been several elections, most of which he's won, he has his control of the judiciary, his control of the military, his control of the state oil company, his control of the central bank, makes him an autocrat within a democratic context.
And I guess perhaps the message here is not so much domestic, but for regional players, in that his term is up in 2012. If this referendum holds his popularity, he's going to be around for longer than a decade. If he lasts to 2019, that means he's definitely someone that's going to have to be reckoned with by everyone, from the leader of Brazil to the leader in Washington.
I think that's absolutely right. I'm not a betting man, but I think it's going to be very difficult for the opposition to find a candidate to take him on in the next round of presidential elections due in December 2012. So far, they have suffered from splits and disorganization. And I think it's going to be very difficult to see them beating Chavez. So he's going to be around for several years to come.
Of course, neither of us are betting men here, but looking forward, is it possible for Hugo Chavez to export his popularity outside of Venezuela? We've already seen a sense of containment. Uribe in Colombia has really raised his profile as a right-wing leader and has much more popularity within South America than Chavez does. What is the chance that he could form alliances outside of, say, Cuba, that are going to be geostrategically significant in this hemisphere?
Well, he already has the support of some Latin American governments who are sympathetic to him. It's not just Cuba. There's the Bolivian government, there's the Ecuadorian government, there's the Nicaraguan government. But the key players, if you like, in Latin America, particularly for the new Obama administration, are Mexico and Brazil. President Lula of Brazil is much more significant player geopolitically and within Latin America than Hugo Chavez.
Is there anything in Lula's interest to actually unite himself or in any way be sympathetic with Hugo Chavez, or no?
I don't think he will sort of jump into bed with him, if you like. He will keep him at arm's length. He won't publicly, or in the past at least, he hasn't publicly criticized him. But Brazil and President Lula are very keen to portray themselves as the real leaders of Latin America and not Hugo Chavez. That's to say, this sort of soft left, center left version of Latin American politics, and not the radical left that Hugo Chavez represents.
So we could conceivably see a Brazilian role as a regional mediator, with Hugo Chavez part of the sort of mediation parties, not necessarily anything confrontational with the United States. Let's look at Mexico, which you referred to a moment ago. Now, there's a country that is faced with significant instability over the next year or so. Anything could happen as far as Mexico and Hugo Chavez are concerned. True or false?
No, I don't think, to be honest. The main drivers of what happens in Mexico are very much its links to the U.S. economy and the downturn in the U.S. economy, plus, as you hinted, what happens in the stepped-up fight about the spreading role of drugs traffickers in Mexico. I don't think, to be honest, Chavez has got very minimal influence over what goes on in Mexico, and indeed relations between them are not fantastic. So I don't think he's a major player there.
So more of a consolidation, not really an aggressive increase in Chavez's profile. Would that be the verdict?
I think that's absolutely right. His main problem is domestic now. He's got to, I think, at some point sooner or later introduce a series of economic measures which will be painful to cope with the declining oil price. He may be all right for a few months because they've got big international reserves, but at some point he's going to have to maintain his popularity within the context of much less money to spend.
Well, Chavez, let's not forget, wants oil to be priced at $100 a barrel. Last week it was trading in the 30s. My guest was Latin American analyst James Painter of the BBC World Service in an interview conducted earlier this morning. Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, no longer term limited as a result of a national referendum. He won by a larger than expected amount. Femi Okeh has the headlines.
Good morning. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. President Obama will sign his economic stimulus bill into law in Denver tomorrow. After that, he goes to Phoenix to unveil a plan to ease the housing crisis. Meanwhile, the president is not going to appoint a car czar to oversee restructuring of the American auto industry. That task goes instead to a group with a less catchy name, the President's Task Force on Autos. It will be led by the Treasury Secretary and National Economic Council Director. Now, even though she doesn't look a day over 25, this year marks Barbie's 50th birthday. Models representing her still turned heads at a show during New York's Fashion Week, and they went down the runway to this. That's Aqua's 90s hit, Barbie Girl, the show that featured designers inspired by famous Barbie outfits as well as designs from top-name designers. Now, speaking of birthdays, North Korean leader Kim Jong-il turns 67 today. The country celebrated with lavish displays of synchronized swimming, rallies and tributes in state-owned media.
He's older than Barbie.
He is definitely older. But not quite as plastic.
My favorite segues of all time, Femi. That was amazing.
Yes, thank you. We worked on that one.
Not as much of a fashion pillar as Barbie.
No, unfortunately not.
Although very distinctive.
Extremely, particularly in the hair department.
Yes, indeed. And that's all we'll say about Kim Jong-il, who still is elusive in public. Thank you, Femi. Okay.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Now, how to deal with the Taliban? Our next story takes a look at the perils and urgency of dealing with the Islamic group known for its territorial gains in Afghanistan. But now Pakistan's regional government in Northwest Frontier Province have made a deal that the entire South Asian region will be watching, including the United States. Regional Pakistani officials say they'll impose Islamic law in parts of the Northwest Frontier Province where Taliban fighters increasingly hold sway. Joining us to talk about the details of this controversial decision is Haroon Rashid, correspondent for the BBC's World Service. He joins us from Islamabad, Pakistan. Haroon, this is a really interesting breakthrough that originally was just about a ceasefire, a laying down of arms by certain Taliban leaders.
Yes, of course, it has gone as a big relief for the people of this insurgency hit Swat district. They have been seeing this violence for the last 2 years. And this breakthrough that was yesterday announced and formally signed today, the government hopes to introduce Sharia courts in that district so that people can get quick and early justice on their doorsteps. The early signs from the militants are also quite positive. They have announced a unilateral 10-day ceasefire in that district. So people are hoping that they get into this agreement and formalize and permanently make this ceasefire so that the district is allowed to return to normalcy.
Well, Haroon, isn't this going to play as a concession by the Pakistani government to the Taliban? And is this really likely to pacify Taliban fighters on the Afghan side of the border?
As far as Pakistani government is concerned, they are saying that they haven't given out anything extra. It is all in the constitution. It is all in the laws of the country. and according to human rights of the local people, they have just facilitated them, and since they wanted Sharia system in their district, they have given it to them. As far as the militants are concerned, I think to a large extent, some of the militants might agree to this agreement and decide not to fight the Pakistani security forces anymore. But there will be still a small chunk of these militants, hardline militants, including Al-Qaeda foreign element, who would not like to have this ceasefire, because they are still saying that although this is a good agreement, but their political agenda extends far beyond that district. They want this system in the whole of the country, and in fact the whole world. So you can easily judge what sure. their aims are.
Finally, there are cynics in Islamabad there who will say that this actually just makes public a relationship between the Pakistani government, particularly the ISI, and the Taliban, which goes back a long, long time. Anybody talking that way this morning?
No, not at the moment. I mean, the Pakistani former president has come out strongly against making any statements against the ISI or the Pakistani army at the moment. He says this will weaken the war against terror, which the world cannot afford. So I think the general impression here is that the ISI and the military is on the side of the political government.
So a deal with the Taliban. Harun Rashid, correspondent for the BBC's World Service in Islamabad, Pakistan. Thanks for joining us.
Thank
a
you.
Controversial deal between Pakistani regional government officials and the Taliban to lay down arms in Northwest Frontier Province, where Taliban hold territorial gains.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, the IKEA effect. What's that? An edible lamp, you say? No, no, no. It's actually a value-added proposition that our friend Dan Ariely, predictably irrational economist from Duke University, will explain in just a moment, right after headlines from Femi Okay.
Hello there. 12 minutes to the top of the hour, just about. New numbers from Japan show the economy is shrinking by more than 12% on an annual basis, and that's the fastest drop in Japan in 35 years, and more than triple the recent drop in the U.S. economy. Senator Roland Burris, who was appointed to the U.S. Senate by the now-impeached governor of Illinois, is hearing calls for his resignation. Some Illinois state lawmakers want Roland Burris investigated for possible perjury. Burris, over the weekend, released an affidavit that contradicts statements he made in front of an Illinois House panel investigating the governor, Blagojevich. Now, we've just been talking this morning about the Pakistani authorities. They have formally announced an agreement to implement Islamic law on the northwestern Swat Valley in an effort to end bloody Taliban insurgency there. But the co-chairman of the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan, Iqbal Haider, said that militants are just trying to take over Pakistan.
The barbaric, extremist, militant, religious fanatics are trying to ensure they usurp the sovereignty and integrity and the territory of Pakistan.
And the implementation of Sharia law has been a central demand of militants in the region who have been opposing the security forces for nearly a year. Let's look at some of the big stories making news this morning, John.
It's interesting whether that's concession to the Taliban and whether it's going to have any impact on what's going on in Afghanistan. Thank you so much, Femi.
You're welcome.
So we're about to learn about how DIY or doing it yourself might be the prescription we need in these economic hard times. Our friend Dan Ariely brings us that story in just a second. But, you know, it's easier said than done. Doing it yourself might feel like liberation, but boy, you can sure get into trouble. We heard from Teresa Guidette, who owns Barry County Upholstery in Michigan, who helps people out when they've screwed up on their own DIY projects.
If you don't know how to sew or how to lay a patterning out, I wouldn't even attempt a project, but most people try the simpler projects where there's no sewing. It's just stretching and stapling.
What are your triumphs and complete disasters when you've tried to DIY? Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. 5 million people in the U.S. are unemployed. If you add up all the underemployed workers, it's more than 13 million people, or 13%, more than 13 million people. And that means a lot of people have a lot of time to be assembling their own stuff. If you go to IKEA, there's one in my neighborhood, there's a mob scene every weekend to see people taking boxes home to assemble all kinds of things. But is there an economic theory of doing it yourself? Is assembly required a curse or something of an added value to objects that you can look at your own home and say, hey, I did that? Here with the economic theory behind assembly required is our friend Dan Ariely, the James B. Duke Professor of Behavioral Economics at Duke University. He's the author of Predictably Irrational, and he joins us from Durham, North Carolina. Dan, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, as always.
Now, assembly required seems to me a bit of an annoyance, but for the number of people who go into IKEA and happily volunteer to assemble things themselves, you say there's an economic principle at work here?
Yeah, there are actually a few. But first of all, if you think about self-assembly, it violates a few interesting economic principles. One of the things that we think about economics is the benefit of specializing, that somebody like the woman who does the upholstery gets to specialize in it, or economies of scale is another one. And when people start doing things themselves, they lose both of these benefits. We're not experts in any of those, and we don't have economies of scale. For example, I saw some estimates that growing a tomato in your own house can be about $20 a tomato because you lose all of these benefits. However, there's some unexpected advantages of doing it yourself, and particularly something we call the IKEA effect. And the IKEA effect is exactly the idea that when you go and you assemble something, you value it more. And we've done it in all kinds of ways, but maybe the simplest one is to say we took pieces of paper and we asked people to build origami. And some people build origami, and then we asked them how much they value their origami, the one that they build, compared to a professionally built origami. And the one that these people built was basically like crumbled pieces of paper compared to the professional one. But they thought that theirs was just as beautiful, just as wonderful. They're willing to pay just as much money for it. And moreover, they thought that other people will value it as much. And even more interesting is that when we gave them worse instructions of how to build the origami, so it was harder, it took them more time, and it looked even uglier, they valued it even more.
Really? I mean, I guess this would apply to some products, but not others. For instance, if my friend put together an airplane, I might not want to fly in it. But for something around the house, maybe this does apply.
So you know, there's a question of how much you think is the quality. And when there's a quality issue, there's a second issue. But even you, think about something like your kids, right? You created them, and the fact that you created them and put a lot of work in them, does this make them more valuable in your mind?
Than any other kids?
Yes.
Well, what do you expect me to say to that? I mean, no, I'll take any kids. Yeah, sure.
So there's something really interesting. There's something interesting about the fact that once we put effort into it, and I think all the do-it-yourself projects are like that, something about us gets involved into the process. And the moment something about us is into the process, it's more valuable, more interesting, more meaningful. So it does have some other meaning. And if you think about IKEA furniture, it's not particularly high-quality furniture, but the fact that we can make it ours, and I think that the bad instructions of how to assemble it actually help, because we spend too much time on it, we put too much pieces the wrong way and then have to fix it, and all of those things actually create higher attachment and evaluation of the product.
You know, you're describing something that I observed actually a couple of times when I watched Habitat for Humanity volunteers put together a house one time in actually the Atlanta area down near to where you are, and then, you know, another time out west. It seemed that, you know, certainly people wanted to help the poor. You know, there were people in a community that definitely wanted new housing. But the quality of everybody pitching in and doing this barn raising really made it a much different kind of experience. And I'm wondering if this IKEA effect is partly what explains the Habitat for Humanity success.
It does. It's at least a part of it. So I went for one of these projects, and I'm really terrible in those things. And I could have paid very little to somebody else who would do a better job than I have. So in economic terms, it's incredibly inefficient to take somebody useless as I am with holding a hammer and letting me do these jobs. At the same time, I feel a much higher connection to the house that I helped building than to any other house, or even if I give somebody some money. So there's an additional value of connection that you get from it. And this actually relates to charity more generally. When you give money to a distant charity, you just don't feel as much. But if you know that you're giving money for a particular kid or for a specific cause or to save something very particular, our emotions get involved in it much more, our connections increases, and therefore we're much more willing to part with our time and money.
Well, there is sort of a trade-off here. There's the economy of scale that you talked about, which comes from the traditional manufacturing economy, which can produce a tomato for, you know, a few cents as opposed to $20 in your window seat. But then there's the value, this intangible value of this cooperation, where if suddenly people are linked together in some cooperative enterprise, there's a lot more that communities can do in these economic times besides simply make objects for themselves. What is the value economically of this cooperation that assembly required actually encourages?
So I think you're maximizing a very different function, right? You're not maximizing spending the lowest money and getting the highest the best product in objective terms. What you're maximizing is something that makes you feel good about yourself. You're maximizing pride. You're maximizing social connections. In fact, I think it's an important lesson for even businesses to think about pride. Many people who work produce one part of the job. They produce like not a whole chair, but they produce a part of the chair, or they don't even produce a whole SAP form. They put a part of it. And as we do just small pieces and don't get to assemble the whole thing, whether it's at our home or at our work, we don't get the same pride and meaning. And I think if we understood that better, for example, at the workplace, we could get people to be much more motivated and excited about what they were doing.
Well, there's a value there, certainly. And, of course, Dan Ariely, James B. Duke Professor of Behavioral Economics at Duke University and author of Predictably Irrational, has identified it as the IKEA effect. Dan, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, there's a value, but there's also a story behind DIY. Do you try to hang up pictures and shelves and rip out huge hunks of drywall or make your own furniture only to make an enormous ordeal for yourself?
Hi, this is Michael from Brooklyn. After 11 years of marriage, I made my wife's Valentine's Day gift out of wood and all the power tools that she's bought me over the years, and she loved it more than anything I've ever bought her.
I'm in tears. Lisa from New Jersey emails us, we bought a DIY bookcase from IKEA, then we shoved it into the car, shattering the windshield, so a $235 bookcase ended up costing us $800, but just think how connected you feel, Lisa. Tell us your stories at our website, thetakeaway.org, or 877-8-MY-TAKE. Your takeaway this hour?
There's never been a major automotive bankruptcy. We have no clue how it would affect thousands of suppliers, dealers, the unions, and other people up and down the chain.
We're going to find out, though. Big deadline for the auto industry. Justin Hyde, reporter for Detroit Free Press, and I'm John Hockenberry on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.